This is a Stimulus Network podcast.
The Cosmic Shed.
Hello, and welcome to The Cosmic Shed. Today's episode is all about exoplanets, life in the universe. They've found a new exoplanet which has water in its atmosphere, water vapour in its atmosphere. And we speak to the lead scientist, Professor Giovanna Tinetti, all about that. And last night, we went to see Ad Astra.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
So we'll probably talk about that too. I'm Andrew, and with me today is...
Steve!
Why are you doing that?
Because it'd be international talk, like a pirate day when we be recording. Okay. Probably irrelevant to whoever's listening.
So, you're in a band, or sort of a singing thing.
I guess you could call it a band.
Can we play a bit?
No.
Why?
Yes, all right. When I'm not doing science-y things, I do a bit of singing. And because we're in Bristol, I do a bit of shanty singing. It sort of lapsed, and now it's reforming with new members, including me. And it's called the Roaring Troman.
You're a lie, Addy, singing to a lie, you're a lie.
And we've been told we're fairly good. We're just shaping up. We're recruiting for a fourth member. And we've just put out the old band's first album on iTunes, Spotify, and all other good distribution channels. So have a search for The Roaring Troman.
Okay, here's a little bit of The Roaring Troman.
Sent me away, singing to a lie, you're a lie, Addy Way. Singing to a lie, you're a lie, hey. Singing to a lie, you're a lie, Addy. And I'll see you in Botany Bay.
Are you not going to say anything piratey, Andrew?
No. So, we'll come to Ad Astra in a minute, but as I say, we've done some episodes on exoplanets before. The incredible discovery of the TRAPPIST-1 planets.
Mm.
We did an episode on that. We'll link to that on the Cosmic Shed website. thecosmicshed.com. But last week there was the announcement of the discovery of the first exoplanet which has water vapour in the atmosphere. And I spoke to Professor Giovanna Tinetti of UCL, University College London, who was the lead author on the paper that made that announcement.
We are very excited because with my team at UCL, we have discovered for the first time the presence of water vapor in the atmosphere of a planet that is not too different from the Earth. It's a sort of an Earth cousin. And so it's very exciting to know more about this planet that is called K2-18b. K2-18b is 8 times the mass of the Earth and orbits a star that is smaller and colder than the Sun. So it's not exactly the Earth twin, but is a sort of a cousin. What is most important of this planet is that it is at the right distance to the stars so that the planet is in a so-called habitable zone. So in principle, you have a temperature that is compatible with liquid water. Now, this is the definition of habitable zone, but what is interesting about the observations that we published in Nature Astronomy is that it shows for the first time that indeed there is an atmosphere around the planet, and in that atmosphere there is water vapor. Of course, one of the conditions for habitability is the presence of liquid water. Now, we haven't seen liquid water with Hubble observations. It's not possible to see liquid water, but having water vapor in the atmosphere, it's certainly an extra step towards our understanding of the potential habitability of that planet.
Is there water vapour on any other body in our solar system apart from Earth?
No, absolutely not. For instance, Venus, that is as small as the Earth, and it is located at 0.7 astronomical units. The Earth is one astronomical unit. Venus actually is very hot at the surface, and the atmosphere is very dry. It's made of carbon dioxide and some clouds of sulfuric acid. There is basically no water in that atmosphere. Both the oxygen and the hydrogen are sort of trapped in these horrible sulfuric acid clouds. So definitely no water in Venus. And on Mars, there is no liquid water. You have a tiny bit, but really, really minor amounts of water vapor in the atmosphere. And then you have H2O under the form of ice trapped in the solar caps. Then in the giant planets, you don't have water vapor. I mean, we don't see water vapor in the atmosphere because given that these planets are very cold, typically water condenses very deep in the atmosphere of those planets. So basically we can't really see upper in the atmosphere the presence of water vapor. So bottom line, for solar system planets, actually it's just for Earth that we're seeing water vapor in the atmosphere.
Are both Venus and Mars inside the habitable zone of our sun?
Of course, there are many, as you might imagine, many definitions of habitable zone, meaning some definitions are a bit more flexible than others. But let's say that Venus is definitely on the hot side, so it's not really in the habitable zone. And in fact, in reality, it's not. Mars potentially could be in a sort of continuous habitable zone. The problem with Mars is that through time, it's a relatively small planet. So through time, it has lost a part of its atmosphere. It's a very tiny atmosphere, what you have on Mars today. And so without the buffer of the atmosphere that is making some greenhouse gas effect in a certain sense on Mars, the planet can't really have the sort of stable temperature and the stable pressure of the atmosphere to maintain liquid water at the surface. And here we have a planet for which we have seen water vapor in the atmosphere. The temperature is compatible also with the presence of liquid water. So it suggests that, you know, you have the right condition potentially to have liquid water at the surface. The density of the planet is suggestive of what we call in jargon ocean planets, which are basically planets where the density is suggesting an interior of a mixture of ice and rock, a little bit like the moons of the giant planets in our own solar system. For those planets, it could be that if you have a layer of ice at the right condition of pressure and temperature, it might be that at the surface you have an ocean. So I'm not suggesting on this planet is the case because we don't know from the observations. But again, we're going from just speculating on one dot and knowing just the mass of the dot and then the size of the dot and the distance from the star to having observations that all of a sudden tell us something about the atmosphere of the planet and is a little bit about the chemistry of the atmosphere. So it's a big step forward.
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, really, really amazing. So where is it?
So it's at 110 roughly light years away, which in galactic distance is just the neighborhood. But for human beings, it's simply impossible to get there.
And are there other planets orbiting the star?
Yes, yes, yes. There are other two planets orbiting the star.
And would we know anything about moons orbiting this planet? Or
no, for the moment we don't. Finding moons is not easy. There was a moon that was announced last year, a more massive moon. Of course, current observations are not always optimal for this kind of measurements. You need to have very precise timing. So it is not very easy today to find moons. Depends also how big is the moon. So I'm not saying there isn't a moon. I'm just saying we don't know.
If the planet is 8 times the mass of Earth, does that mean that the gravity is significantly higher as well?
It's a bit more, the gravity, but not 8 times more, because the radius is larger. So in the end, roughly twice the gravity of the Earth. So we're not talking about an enormous amount.
Okay.
Okay. So again, it's not the right planet in any case for us human being. Also because there is still hydrogen in the atmosphere. But again, there are many organisms on Earth that are living in even more challenging conditions. So again, in principle, there is nothing that tells us for the moment that it's not habitable. I stress that we can't say right now that it's habitable. I'm just saying we are collecting information and it is definitely an interesting candidate to be looked at for visibility. And so hopefully we'll be able to point future telescope at this planet and no more.
How many planets have we seen the atmosphere of?
Okay, so far we have been observed the atmosphere of 40 roughly, had Jupiters and Neptunes. We published a catalogue, my team at UCL has published a catalogue, it was last year actually. Unfortunately, what we know today, again, is quite limited given to the limitation of current instrumentation. Most of the time we can pick up water vapours is there. In other cases, if there are clouds, you might have some problem in seeing the signal, the atmosphere altogether. In a very few cases of very, very hot planets, exotic molecules as TiO and so titanium oxide and vanadium oxide have been suggested, a few more molecules. On top of that, we have one super Earth that is extremely hot, 55 Cancri E. And again, we looked at that with my team at UCL in 2016. That planet seems to show an atmosphere around it, which is not given, given that the planet has a temperature of 2000 Kelvin or so. So really, really hot. It orbits its own star in less than one day. And the star is very similar to the sun. So is not very pleasant environment. But from the observations, again, from Hubble, it seems that there is an atmosphere around it. We don't know yet exactly what is the composition. What we can say, though, is that there is not water vapor, or at least these observations do not show the signature of water vapor.
So you've not looked at very many rocky planets at all, and yet we've already found one with water vapor in the atmosphere.
Correct. I mean, we just have this 55 Cancri E, which again is another planet which is 8 times the mass of the Earth, sort of similar in terms of basic parameter, but very much closer to the star. And then there is a small Neptune called GJ1214b. This one seems to be overcast from the little we can say, because the signature from Hubble shows a quite flat spectrum. And so people have interpreted that as a potential signature of clouds. Bottom line, we don't know exactly what is happening in our atmosphere. So this is the third one, and it's a special third one.
Oh, I mean, that's just amazing, isn't it? It wasn't long ago that exoplanets were something we believed probably existed, but we hadn't actually seen any of them. Now, just a few short years later, we've seen over 4,000 of them now. And as they say, there are more stars in the night sky than there are grains of sand on all the beaches of Earth. And when we look up into the night sky, the suggestion is that most of those stars have planets orbiting them. And then the third one that we look at the atmosphere of has got water vapor in it. It's only pointing in one direction, isn't it?
So that's why we are so excited. And of course, we look at many other of similar objects, because more and more super Earths have been observed and being discovered, and they will have a great space telescope in the future. And so maybe it will turn out that there are many similar objects, and after all, for whatever reasons, they are not habitable at all. This is entirely possible, but it's absolutely fascinating at the moment to even be in the position to be able to ask this question in a more scientific and observational manner.
Yeah. But how did you measure what was in the atmosphere of a planet 110 light years away?
So, of course, we can't get there. So what we are doing is to play tricks in a certain sense in order to separate the contribution of the light from the planet from the contribution of the light from the star. There are, let's say, 2 or 3 techniques to do that. The one that was used to observe this particular planet is basically waiting for the planet to pass in front of the star, what we call transit. And when that is happening, basically we're looking at how the light from the star is absorbed by the atmosphere of the planet. Given that the atmosphere is made of gas, gas is transparent in some cases or more opaque in others. And it's typically more opaque when the molecules in the atmosphere absorb in the light. And so by looking at the fingerprints or how this light is being absorbed, then you can find out what is the molecule absorbing. Because luckily for us, at least, a molecule has a quite unique signature. So each molecule has its own specific and unique way of absorbing light. And so if you see how the light is absorbed by the atmosphere of the planet, then you can work out, go in a certain sense, backwards and understand what is the molecule that is doing that sort of behavior.
That's amazing, isn't it? I mean, when you were starting out in astronomy or maybe studying physics at school, did you think that maybe, I mean, even consider that maybe one day you might be able to do this?
No, to be really frank with you, I always dreamt to be a physicist and not an astrophysicist.
Okay.
And so my dream was more when I was 10, I really decided I really want to study physics. But in my mind, I had this romantic way of being Marie Curie or something like that. So it was more the atom and nuclear physics. And then during my PhD, exosolar planets started to be discovered. And I thought it was absolutely fascinating field. And so I decided to change your field and to move into this fascinating research.
Oh, it's just really amazing. Do you like science fiction?
Rarely is the answer. It really needs to be done well. So occasionally I like science fiction. Since it's a little bit my job, and not that I'm not suggesting that what we're doing is science fiction, but it's too close to science fiction.
Yeah.
So it really needs to be done well. And okay. So for instance, I love The Martian. I thought it was a great movie and well done, right spirit, and also quite accurate. And so this is one of my favorite movie. In Interstellar, I loved the part about the planets. I thought that also that part was quite accurate. I didn't like too much the part about the gravity and all that. Again, I'm expressing just an opinion here, of course.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But said that, I grew up in Italy, and when I was a kid in the 70s, we had all these cartoons in TV coming from Japan, and they were all about aliens and fighting aliens and traveling in space and all that. So I don't know, I suppose that somehow that kind of a child culture is, yeah.
Have you seen Arrival?
No.
Oh, it's amazing. You should watch Arrival. If you like those ones, it's another one on the list that you just do. It doesn't have the same kind of space exploration side of things, but it is all about this alien question. If somebody said to you that, you know, in the style of Interstellar, you could get to this planet, would you?
No, because it's not really good for humans. So.
But what if there was some special suit that you could use to help you live on the surface?
There are too many ifs.
Okay, fair enough.
I prefer to look at planets from afar.
Thank you so much to Professor Giovanna Tinetti there. I mean, it's just amazing. I did say in that there are 3,500 exoplanets. That was wrong. There's over 4,000 exoplanets now. But there has been a bit of a disagreement between scientists about the composition of the planets. The UCL paper says that it is a super Earth, and then there's another paper which is it says that it's like Neptune. But either way, to find water vapor, which is all we couldn't expect to find more than water vapor at the moment, we don't have the technology to find water itself in the atmosphere of the third planet that we look at the atmosphere of. I mean, it just screams that there's water all over the place, right?
I am not a statistician, but it sounds pretty exciting. Yeah. I love this stuff. The whole idea of looking so far into the universe that we can see the composition of a tiny, tiny, tiny dot over there when 100 years ago we didn't even know about some of the planets in our own solar system is just phenomenal.
Yeah.
And this is a really interesting time because we're launching new satellites, we're discovering new, inventing new techniques to see further and see more sharply. So we're finding out so much.
Mm. And we're going to find more, aren't we? Sorry to interrupt. We're going to find more because the James Webb Space Telescope is going to go up there and it's going to, you know, that's the successor to Hubble. We've talked about it before in the shed. And it's going to go up and it will be able to actually look in more depth at the atmosphere of these planets. And then we might start seeing actual water in the atmosphere.
It's... I love the idea of looking at exoplanets, of looking for signs of extraterrestrial life and all the discussion and probabilities and philosophy that comes along with that. And the fact that we've got this big goal and we're bumping up against scientific limitations of resolution of telescopes, of things that we have to look past and through.
Mm.
Which brings us nicely...
Doesn't it to Ad Astra? So we went to see Ad Astra last night.
Warning! Spoilers ahead. Oh, yeah, we are going to be talking in great detail about some plot points of this film. If you haven't watched it and you intend to watch it and you don't want to know about it or what we thought about it, then hit pause, listen to something else for now, and go watch it tonight.
Yeah. The other thing I would say is, if you really enjoyed it, you might want to skip this chat. Because I always think if I've really enjoyed a film, I don't want to hear people who haven't enjoyed it.
Did you not enjoy it, Andrew?
I didn't enjoy it. We'll come to that.
Control, if you're getting that, over.
Do you want to tell us about the film in the absence of Ty?
Oh, yes, I do wish Ty was here because he does it so much better than me, and I can't even remember the actors' names. Ad Astra, to the stars.
Major, we have some highly classified information.
What can you tell us about the Lima Project?
Its objective was to search for advanced extraterrestrial life. The ship disappeared approximately 16 years into the mission.
And the commander was?
He was my father, sir.
Tommy Lee Jones went out on a mission... some time ago, to look for extraterrestrial life. And apparently the big barrier to observing was the fact that the heliosphere gets in the way. So this mission needed to go beyond the heliopause, the edge of the heliosphere. The heliosphere is the vast bubble-like region of space which surrounds and is created by the sun. The bubble of the heliosphere is inflated by plasma originating from the sun, known as the solar wind. Basically, it's this big shockwave that the sun creates.
I like to think of it as the influence of the sun on space, so beyond where the sun doesn't have any effect.
Yes, it's like a pebble in a stream. You get this shockwave around it.
But just to go back slightly, Tommy Lee Jones.
Tommy Lee Jones
has to go to the edge of Neptune. Why not Pluto?
It's not even the main part of the film, no. Is it? This is just the introduction.
Yeah, and he has to go there in order to get past all the things that are blocking us from discovering if there is intelligent life in the universe.
Which is super cool. That'd be an amazing film in itself, wouldn't it? This is just an incidental setup point.
Yeah. Apart from the fact that the heliosphere doesn't actually block the things that we need to tell whether there's intelligent life in the universe.
Or that the heliosphere... actually extends beyond Neptune.
Yeah. Quite.
There's some interesting science in this film. Mission vanishes, funky things start happening, strange electrical shockwaves start emanating from Neptune towards Earth, knocking out power systems, causing general havoc and annoying some important Department of Defense people.
It's crazy out there. There's fires everywhere and plane crashes. They're calling it the Surge.
Major.
So, they find Brad Pitt,
who
is Tommy Lee Jones' son,
who
is also trained to be an astronaut and done other things, and does some... The film opens with Brad Pitt up this massive... I thought it was a space elevator, but they said it was an antenna.
Yeah, that's very cool.
That is an excellent shot, and I wish there was more cool stuff like that in this film.
Yeah,
Brad Pitt's badass with flaws because he didn't recognise that Liv Tyler was so amazing and ignored her in favour of his work.
And the other person who pretty much ignores Liv Tyler in the film is the director, James Gray. So Ad Astra is directed and written by James Gray, also written by Ethan Gross, and produced by Brad Pitt, D.D. Gardner, Jeremy Kleiner, James Gray. It stars Brad Pitt, Tommy Lee Jones, Ruth Negger, Liv Tyler, Donald Sutherland, and Russian Doll.
Hey, bartendress. Hello. More junk, please.
But no. Oh, she's the receptionist for the secret place, isn't she?
Yeah. There was a review that I read which said that Liv Tyler's role was largely undercooked. I think that's generous. She's just really not in it. And Tushna Commissariat, friend of the Cosmic Shed, came to watch the film with us. She turned to me at the end and said, "What have we just watched? I feel like I've just watched 2.5 hours, it's not even that long, 2.5 hours of a Brad Pitt perfume commercial."
Do you know what else I noticed during that movie?
No.
Well, Maddie Nichols, who's also often in the shed sometimes, was there, and I think I heard a little snore come from
her. Yeah, she did have a snooze.
Yes.
And that is partly why Maddie is not joining us today, because she didn't really see the film, because she was so nonplussed that she fell asleep. So let me just go back slightly, because I have been incredibly excited about this film. I've been looking forward to this film from the moment that I heard that there was a film coming out called Ad Astra.
Listeners, Andrew has been looking forward to this so much that any time I even mention that I saw a trailer or something, he just runs away and puts his hands over his ears.
I did an amazing job of avoiding all spoilers, and I literally went into it knowing three things. One, it was called Ad Astra. Two, it had Brad Pitt. And three, it was released on September the 18th. Now, I also saw that on the bus, but those are the three things that I knew about it. So I was incredibly excited because it was called Ad Astra. That's enough for me.
I was excited / apprehensive because it's one of those films that didn't get promoted as much as I think all sci-fi films should be, which either means it's fairly niche and of extreme interest only to sci-fi fans.
Which we're fine with.
Which we're great with. I mean, The Martian is a perfect example of that. The book and the film, both amazing. And initially underpromoted, now, obviously, everywhere. Or the studio has decided not to promote it too much because they know the reception it's going to receive.
Yeah. So I guess I should have known, because we tend to go to the cinema in Bristol which has the largest screen. And they weren't showing it on the largest screen.
What were they showing on the big screen, Andrew?
I got it wrong. I thought they were showing Downton Abbey, which made no
sense. It's been out a while, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it was It.
Oh, fair play.
Yeah, which is kind of okay to show on the big screen, so fair enough.
I don't know, clowns should be limited in their size. Yeah.
But if you've got the opening night of a big space sci-fi, that should be... It's shot in the IMAX as well.
Yeah, and space is cool these days, right?
Then you would think it would be on the big screen. The thing to say is that I'm really confused about, because, as we'll come to, there are lots of reasons why I didn't like it. The thing I'm confused about is that it's getting really very good reviews.
Is it?
Yeah.
There were some long, slow, almost ballet-like scenes where they were trying to be a bit 2001.
Yep.
And to me, they utterly failed.
Yep.
But do you think the critics are getting all the bits that maybe went over my head?
No. What could possibly have gone over your head?
I don't know. Maybe there's allusions to other classic movies in there that I don't recognise. Maybe all the long pauses are valuable. I think I've got nothing wrong with long pauses. 2001 is a fantastic film.
Yeah. And I think Solaris. That Solaris is amazing. I love the original Russian Solaris.
I haven't seen that.
Oh, it's beautiful. Arrival has long, beautiful, poetic giving the camera, giving the scenes time. I love that stuff.
And there are some huge scientific inaccuracies in pretty much every single scene of this film. Uh-huh. And I think that it was probably a choice or a deliberate non-attention to the detailed hard science in there by the director and producer teams, in favour of the story. It's very much story before science. It's got great special effects.
Yeah, it looks amazing.
And it has this intense sort of father-son slash political slash dramatic storyline that could be really good, but isn't.
I do what I do because of my dad. He was a hero. He gave his life for the pursuit of knowledge.
You could read the film quite easily as an allegory for a son trying to connect with a mentally ill, in some way, father.
Mm-hmm.
I am in that situation. I have a father with dementia. And there are parts of the film where I'm thinking, this is a direct allegory for my life.
This might come as quite a shock to you. Your father was experimenting with a highly classified material that could threaten our entire solar system. All life would be destroyed. We're counting on you to find out what's happening out there.
It just doesn't work. And then I think the reason why it falls down is that I don't care about the characters. Not one character makes me want them to succeed.
He is very impersonal and cold, and I can see what they were trying to do there. He's thrown himself into his work, he's single-minded, but yeah, he leaves me quite cold as well. And the same with Tommy Lee Jones. Again, it's this tormented, torn character who's hailed as a hero back on Earth because of this big cover-up, has done some horrific things in pursuit of this higher goal and ultimately been disappointed. And regardless of all the pointless anal sci-fi nitpicking that I can do and I'm going to do about this film, the storyline could be a really, really poignant one. The peak of that arc, I feel, is when Brad Pitt and Tommy Lee Jones are leaving the space station for the last time.
Mm-hmm.
And Tommy Lee Jones has let Brad Pitt suit him up, get him out there, get ready to go back home.
Mm-hmm.
Which in itself was could have been a hugely poignant sort of thing. I think that did get me a little bit. The son having to do everything with the father because the father wasn't capable of it, and the father letting him do that.
Yeah.
And then Tommy Lee Jones fires his spacesuit thrusters and tries to jet off, but he's tethered to Brad Pitt, and Brad Pitt pulls him back, and they're holding on. And Tommy Lee Jones says, "Let me go, son," several times. And that should have been the most incredibly heart-wrenching point of the movie.
Should have been.
And it wasn't.
No. And why wasn't it for you? Because I think for me it wasn't, because they lost me so many times up to that point. Like, the very opening of, from the get-go, there are so many, the science is so wrong in the first 20 minutes that I was actually, after 20 minutes, thinking, I literally either don't know anything about science or this is so scientifically inaccurate.
I think I can let go of the science when I need to. I love science fantasy and just fantasy as much as sci-fi. And this was a movie that seemed to be portraying itself, at least to the general audience, as fairly scientifically accurate with its high-quality special effects. And there wasn't any crazy aliens. It was all tech that pretty much exists, and it said it's in the very near future. Mm. But putting all of that aside, just the character development, I think that the reason that I didn't care about that scene was because I didn't care about the characters. And Brad Pitt and Tommy Lee Jones are good actors. Mm-hmm. They've had their fair share of good and bad movies, both.
Mm.
But they are good actors, and for it to leave me that cold, I wonder if there is some huge directorial mistakes that have happened there.
Because Tushner also said that she felt like there was a very religious message in it. And I'm not sure about that. I believe James Gray does have religious undertones in a lot of his films, which is fine, obviously.
It would have been interesting to see how that universe had... That timeline had got to where it was,
yeah.
And why religion and science had seemed to come back together.
Yeah.
But there was just no exposition on it at all. Yeah. Again, maybe it was a three-hour movie that they had to cut to 2 hours.
Maybe. My fear is that set pieces like the moon buggy chase with the space pirates...
Mm.
But we have what looks like unidentified rovers approaching our position. Possible pirate activity. Alpha, we need backup ASAP. We're being ambushed.
LRB-2 down.
Roy,
I have a puncture.
Like the detour to the Mayday with the
Norwegian spaceship,
yeah.
with the
exploding monkey.
Is it baboon a monkey?
Monkey, baboon, ape. There was no need for that scene in the story. It was a real detour.
And it was horrific.
Yeah.
It was a real... Yeah, right. It was a set piece, but it had no purpose at all.
Yeah. My fear is that that's been added, and the maybe not consciously, but the director... writers have added that and the car chase on the moon.
And the big antenna collapse thing.
Yeah, which is not necessary.
No, cool.
But brilliant, that is brilliant, to be fair. And also the moon buggy chase is really cool.
Mm.
But my concern is that they've added those to attract a kind of Transformers, if you wish, audience. Mm. And it actually could have been a really good cerebral film if they'd concentrated more on making the film that people seem to think it is. You know, if the films that I wanted it to be sitting amongst are 2001, hard push, but ideally, Interstellar, it totally could have been there, Gravity, it could have been there.
The Martian,
exactly. Those are the four films which I'm thinking, okay, we've got one coming here that's in that group. And not that they're all as good as each other, but they're all, I love them all in their own ways.
They're all great in their own different ways.
Yeah.
Hypothesis,
yeah.
Was it trying to beat all of them and failed at that?
Maybe.
Or were those set pieces just put in there for the trailers?
Yeah.
Shall we watch the trailer?
Okay,
right now?
Yeah.
Have we got time on the recording?
Yeah, I'll pause.
I'm ready.
You were saying, I bet those sequences are in it, and they are.
Every single one of them.
Yeah. If I'd seen that trailer, I'd have been as excited as I was. Anyway, it looks great. Actually, having seen the trailer, I now want to watch the film again. I want to give it another go and give it a chance. But we went to see it. There were six of us, five of us scientists and me. And
you're an honorary scientist, aren't you?
Thanks. I believe I'm actually a social scientist, but that's by... accident rather than design.
We'll allow that.
Thanks. Yeah, all of us, it fell flat for us, right?
Mm. Well, just back to the trailer. There was as much Liv Tyler in the trailer as there was in the movie.
Yes. And just while we were watching that, you said something which made no sense at all in the film, which is when they're walking down the corridor and everything just starts to turn black as they're doing it. It really makes no sense at all.
Yeah, there must have been a cut scene that explained what was going on outside in this space station. Maybe something big was going past the window.
Yeah. But, you know, looking again at the trailer and thinking back to watching the film, it does look incredibly beautiful. It's kind of a bit Soviet in... It's definitely the American Space Agency, but... I really enjoyed that Soviet feel, and that was pulling me along as I was watching it with the doubts about the science being so wrong so many times. The Soviet feel and the way that it looked was pulling me along until they got to Mars, and he was in that kind of padded cardboard, slightly looking a little bit like Interstellar bookshelves at the end. And he was underground on Mars doing a secret laser message from Mars to Neptune. Why did they have to go from Mars?
So, on the first part of your comment, the Soviet sort of visuals, I hadn't clocked it at the time, but I guess you're right. I was... It definitely feels industrial and blocky and concrete and that sort of thing, but it felt appropriate to what they were doing. They were exploring into space, and it was a competitive thing. The moon was basically a war zone because different countries were fighting for territory and pirates. which I loved. I'd love to explore that timeline some more.
But that, if the film had then gone off and you'd find out more about those pirates, then that scene would have made sense. But as it was, it didn't.
So Mars, I really liked that scene in that room. That was their top secret interplanetary transmission facility, and the walls were covered in acoustically absorbent shapes. Yeah, we've got a wind tunnel at the university that's got all of that inside it, and you go a little bit mad when you're in there because you can't hear any echoes and your own voice sounds really weird and stuff. And I've just covered a wall of my office in those, so
have
I can
you?
Podcast from the office. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
And some of them were obviously like manufactured ones, and others, the wonky cardboardy ones, I think were supposed to be made from Martian soil or something. It's all been constructed with the resources that they've got on the planet. So there's some really interesting detail. The set designers, the animators, the visual effects people, just amazing, amazing compliments to them. Yeah. There was some fantastic work there.
Yeah.
Onto the transmission. So the... they were in that super secret underground room, and it was all noise isolated, I guess, so that they couldn't be spied on. Yeah. Maybe it was not just acoustic absorption, it was... electromagnetic absorption stuff. Mm-hmm. And they had to go to Mars because the electrical shockwave thing that came from Neptune had knocked out all surface communications.
Okay.
So they had an underground facility on Mars that hadn't been disrupted
That.
They mentioned it very, very briefly in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they had to use this magical laser transmission. I guess... Well, probably because it's the only facility that still survived.
Yeah.
Or because you can communicate at light speed, but you can get the radio waves.
Yeah.
I don't know what the time to travel at light speed from Mars to Neptune was, but they probably did some time compression there.
They did some time compression.
Well, we're 8 minutes from the sun, aren't we?
Yeah.
8 light minutes.
Yeah.
So Neptune's going to be hours away.
Yeah.
They
did some time compression on the trip to the moon as well, didn't they?
Oh, all of it. If it's in the near future and they're using standard rocket technology,
it takes 3 days.
It takes 6 months to get to Mars.
Yeah, but the moon trip seems to take. There's that fun scene, and I'm thinking this is going to be good. They're on the kind of shuttle to the moon, and he asks for a pillow or something, and it's going to be $125.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably cheap for the weight it is.
But it literally feels like it's an hour and a half journey or something, and which doesn't make any sense.
The Neptune journey, we saw him doing some stuff like putting a stomach feeding tube in, and there was one very brief shot where it looked like he connected a TENS machine to his muscles, which is obviously to stop them atrophying if he's in zero G for months, sleeping on the way to Mars. On the way to Neptune. And again, loads of interesting sci-fi nerdiness that was just a brief second in the movie. But yeah, the rocket stuff, the orbital transfer stuff was all horribly, horribly broken.
Yeah.
Both changing orbits around the same planet and going between planets. The bit where they just decide to stop to respond to this Mayday signal, which led to an interesting scene, completely pointless, but interesting scene. But the idea that you've got enough propellant mass on a rocket to just stop and then carry on is ridiculous. I mean, I if it was on its own way to the moon, no, it just doesn't work.
No,
it really. I need to get back to the office and load up MATLAB and see if I can work out a way that they could do that. But I don't think I can be bothered.
No, it doesn't. It's really not worth it. So exposition. I'm actually fairly tolerant, I think, of exposition. This where they describe what's happening to somebody on screen who should already know what's going on is bad exposition. There's a moment in this film where it just took me totally out of the film, where they say to Brad Pitt's character, who's a major and an astronaut, a major in the military and an astronaut, they say to him, and our big rockets are on the other side of the moon, where they can then launch off to go out into the solar system, as if he wouldn't know that. It's totally ridiculous.
I didn't even notice that one because of the other ridiculously major exposition that happened at about 10 points during the movie. Do you know what I'm talking about?
As best you can, please describe your current mental and emotional state.
I'm feeling good, ready to do my job to the best of my abilities.
Brad Pitt has to do regular psychological check-ins to prove that he's fit to continue with the mission, which is sensible. Maybe real astronauts do that. But it was just this ridiculous device for Brad Pitt to say, no, I'm not feeling anything.
Yeah.
Until he was and he had to hide it. And that was one of the very few parts of the movie where you could feel for his character, I think. Yeah. And that was used far too overtly for the nefarious government to prevent him from continuing with his mission, because he was useless to them now.
Yeah. Well, there's one thing for sure, which is that the psych evaluations do not work, because all of the astronauts in it are a bit...
Well, Brad Pitt's good enough to fool them, except he's not. Mm. The co-pilot of the Moon and Neptune rocket that Brad Pitt has to take over from because he's going to crash them into the moon was a really wet character. And he was supposed to be, but he was wet in an acting sense, not in a sort of character sense.
You had no idea of why he was like that. There's no reason for him to behave that way. He just behaves in a really odd way for somebody who's supposed to be travelling between the moon and Mars on a regular basis. It was really odd.
You know what? I think this would have been better as a 13-episode TV series.
Okay.
Where you've got time to explore all of those different bits. I would, assuming they went into those bits and maybe had a different director, I'd watch that.
That makes me think of that, what's it called? First.
The First.
That's it. The First, which I found decidedly disappointing as well.
Yeah, I won't bother watching that then.
Too pondering, everything goes wrong too often.
I did start watching that.
Yeah, we started watching it and stopped.
It was forgettable, obviously. Yeah,
totally forgettable. Anyway, back to Ad Astra. There's that moment towards the end, after the sequence you've already talked about with letting go of the father, where there's this weird light that seems to come from somewhere, which I didn't really understand what that was.
It's the circles drifting across the screen. Series of that I think that was lens flare, but it was really poorly done.
Right, okay.
It looked like big orange balloons, yeah?
Yeah. Very odd. That's Fudge, the dog next door. But Brad Pitt has a realization that he can take a bit of off the spacecraft and use it to fling himself through Neptune's rings. I have to say, the realisation of Neptune and rings is beautiful.
Mm.
But I'm sitting three seats down from you as Brad Pitt puts a shield of space, a bit of spacecraft door in front of himself.
Hangs on to this spinny radar thing.
Yeah, yeah. And then launches off with his legs to point off into space to rejoin his other spacecraft. And I thought, well, first of all, when he did it, I was like, well, that is brave. This is clearly where he's going to die. But he manages to get through the rings... Using a door as a shield, which is, you know...
Plausible.
But wouldn't those bits of the ring knock him off course every time he goes?
Possibly. The most impressive thing to me of that scene was the fact that he's using this spinny bar, it looked like a radar on a ship thing...
Yeah.
Hanging onto it to launch himself off. And he must have sub fraction of a degree accuracy in two dimensions to be able to stand any chance of hitting this ship.
Yeah.
And I thought he'd grab that door to be some mass to throw away from himself to redirect himself, because that's a classic space thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Chuck the spanner one way so you go the other way.
Yeah.
But no, it was a shield, sensible, yeah, okay, I got that. And then I thought he was going to still use it to chuck himself. But no, he just nails it straight on this fairly small spacecraft. Just, what's the, there's another movie where someone has to do that. Is it The Martian? Someone has to rip a hole in his spacesuit.
But,
Matt Damon turns himself into Iron Man by cutting a finger off his spacesuit or something.
But... the way that
that's more realistic, because he actually has a propulsion method.
And you care deeply about Mark Watney way before that happens. And you're so invested in him getting back to Earth. Whereas this one, it's like, right, he's going to get back to Earth, maybe, and then that'll be that. And...
or he's going to die, and that'll be a sad ending. Oh, well.
Yeah.
By the way, Tommy Lee Jones is just still falling towards Neptune, but no one cares about him.
Yeah. The voiceover thing is really irritating as well. Brad Pitt's voiceover monologue.
What was it? Was there a voiceover?
Yeah, it's not like a voiceover. It's like talking to himself.
Or was it his check-in that they just superimposed over other scenes?
Maybe. I don't know what it was, but there was like he's walking along on the moon and he said, if my dad could see this, he'd blow it all up.
Oh, I remember him saying that. That slipped me by.
Yeah. So... the thing is, we did not enjoy Ad Astra as much as we wanted to.
I've enjoyed slating Ad Astra more than I enjoyed Ad Astra. And I hate myself for slating it, because it had so many good things about it.
Yeah.
I've said about the special effects. I think the premise of it is a good one. It's... like you said, it's a story about a son trying to reconnect with his father. The father is distant in many different ways. And the culmination of it is him finding out his dad never cared and then losing him altogether and then coming back. And did he get back with Liv Tyler at the end? Oh, no, we see her at the door of a coffee shop, don't we?
Yeah.
And that... would be a significant, a great point to finish on if we cared about Brad Pitt and we saw that as him trying to change the flaws in his character.
Yeah.
But we didn't care about him, so no one cares.
No. Quite. Sorry if you enjoyed it. I'm glad that you enjoyed it. I will watch it again. I might try and see it on IMAX so I can see the beauty of it.
Let's just mute it. Let's put it on IMAX screen and mute it.
Yeah.
No, if you do that, I want to come. I want to give it another chance. I really hate criticising movies. Any movie, let alone a big superstar, massive special effect budget one like this, takes a huge amount of effort from thousands of people.
Yeah.
And I appreciate the work that went into this, even though I don't like a lot about the movie.
Totally. I agree with that. And, I should say, we're about to announce some very exciting guests for TronFest.
Which is when?
November the 2nd in Bristol, at the Winston Theatre in Bristol. TronFest, the double bill of the two Tron films. We already have Dr. Pete Etchells, the author of Lost in a Good Game. I mean, couldn't get more apt, really, could you, for Tron?
TronFest is becoming a staple of the Shed calendar.
It is. I am really
looking forward to it.
We've been doing TronFest here in the Shed, watching the films here in the Shed, and we're inviting everyone else who enjoyed us, not in the Shed, but in the Winston Theatre in Bristol. And we have, well, I can't really say who they are yet, but if we manage to get them, then on their credit list they have Star Wars The Last Jedi, they have something in the Marvel Universe, and Doctor Who. They worked on the special effects for those things, joining us at TronFest. Get your tickets via, well, go to thecosmicshed.com and you'll find it. And Steve, thank you very much for joining me here.
Thanks, Andrew.
And thank you very much for listening. We'll be back soon with an episode about Chernobyl, the HBO series.
With a very exciting interview.
And thank you very much for listening.
Thanks, Fudge.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
This podcast is brought to you by the Stimulus Network.
Just briefly, baboons are primates, which apes and monkeys are. And they are an old world monkey. There you go.
Okay.
For the record, I've clarified this, so please don't tweet at me.